Letters on Sympathy by Sophia de Grouchy, first published in 1798. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Letters 6 and 7. Letter 6. The Nature of Justice and Injustice. You have seen, my dear friend, that when the sentiments awakened in us, when we do good or harm to others, are accompanied by reflection, they generate the abstract idea of moral good and evil. This gives rise to the idea of just and unjust, which differs from the other, only in that reason's assent to a just action must be based on the idea of right. A right is a preference, commanded by reason itself, in favour of a particular individual, so that his interests should be favoured, even if it appears to be weaker than someone else's. Thus, for example, a man who in the state of nature has taken the trouble to cultivate a field and to oversee its harvest has a right to this harvest, i.e., reason says that it belongs to him preferentially, because he has bought it by his labour, because in depriving him of it, in nullifying his work, in robbing him of what he had long hoped for and deserved to possess, one does him greater injury than denying him a similar harvest that he had simply found. This preference that reason says should be granted to him, even when he does not need all the fruits of his harvest, and when someone else has a real need for them, is precisely what a right is. It is based on reason, and on the necessity of a general law to regulate actions, a law that is common to all men, and spares us from having to examine the causes and effects of each particular action. And it is likewise based on feeling, because the effect of injustice, being more harmful to the victim than the effects of a simple wrong, must create a greater repugnance in us. At first glance, you may be inclined to think, my dear friend, that in the state of nature, the neighbour of this successful farmer could, without injustice, force him to share his surplus with a third party, who hasn't enough to live on. In thinking about it, you will see that this man's right to the surplus of his harvest comes from his work and not from his needs, that this right began with his work, and even if humaneness should lead him to renounce it, reason does not permit anyone to force him to do so. You will also see that if this man refuses to share his bounty with the poor, he is committing a lesser evil than would be committed by a powerful neighbour who forced him into this beneficent act. The former would lack humaneness. The latter would violate one of those very general laws that reason ordains and gets men to respect by showing that they serve the common interest, and that any good that may come from infringing them in rare particular circumstances is vastly outweighed by the advantages provided by the generality and certainty of these laws. Morality may excuse someone who, in a case of absolute necessity, violates the rights of someone else solely to relieve this immediate need, but it does not follow that this strict right does not exist in general. If it ceases to exist in a case of absolute necessity, it is because in that case the man who refuses necessary subsistence is in a way an enemy, attacking the life of the man he refuses to help. The definition I have given you of right may seem to you incomplete, because the word preference seems contrary to natural equality, which is the basis for a part of real human rights. But this conflict is only apparent, for preference can come into play on behalf of equality. When equality is upset, and there is a choice between putting the sufferer back on a level with the other person or persons, and allowing the other's claim to superiority to stand, though it is not acknowledged by reason, preference should be given to the first of these. So the right one then attains over everything necessary to restore equality is an act of justice, and not a favour. A right such as the right of property is positive. It consists in a reason-based preference for the possession of something. A right such as the right to liberty is in a way a negative, since it exists only on the supposition that it's in someone's interests to attack my freedom. in which case it is reasonable to prefer my interests in preserving it, because there is no reason why this man should have a hold over me that I do not have over him. The same applies to equality. If someone claims a standing over me that is not based on reason, then reason sides with my concern to maintain equality over his concern to obtain his claim. Why? Because submission to someone else's will, and being made inferior to him, does more harm to me than dominating my will, and being superior to me does good to him. In evaluating moral good or evil, we submit the natural sentiment of sympathy to reason, which directs it toward the most pressing claim. In evaluating the just and the unjust, we submit this sentiment to reason that is itself guided by general rules, by a preference based on general and reasoned grounds that aim for the greatest good, that is, guided by the rule of right. Given this exact definition of right, do you not see, my dear friend, how the monstrous edifice of the pretended rights of the despot, the noble, the priest, and all holders of non-delegated power crumbles into dust and instantly vanishes? These prerogatives, these claimed rights, had banished liberty and natural equality from among us, and in so many nations ignorance or weakness still raise them to the rank of rights. As if reason could approve leaving to a sovereign who sometimes can be a tyrant no restraint except his remorse, the progress of enlightenment, or the despair of his victims. As if it authorized the minister of religion, if there were one true religion, to possess obscene riches, and allowed that intolerance could ever be a consequence of his ministry. And finally, as if reason could permit any power that was originally established in the interests of those who are subject to it to become a source of tyrannical privilege and a license for the impunity for its holders? Yet how does it happen that the sacred name of right, which has been used everywhere to hide and disguise the power of force, becomes a mask that is nearly impenetrable to the eyes of the masses, despite the interest they have in tearing it off? Doubtless for a long time now, those who governed men had calculated that they could easily control the ordinary populace by crushing reason under the weight of needs, that they could keep the grandees in line by turning the people over to them and distracting their vanity with trifles, and that all they had to fear was misfortune for the grandees and the spread of enlightenment among the ordinary folk. An action in conformity with right is just. An action contrary to right is unjust. A misfortune created by injustice produces a stronger painful feeling in the victim or the spectator than an equal misfortune that doesn't come from injustice. Why? Because misfortune is greater when it is unexpected. Personal interest can also amplify this feeling. Everyone has rights, and cannot see someone else's rights being violated without being pushed into the disagreeable thought that his own may be violated. Furthermore, injustice involves fraud or violence in those who commit it. It proclaims an enemy to be feared by all. It thus produces unsettling feelings of mistrust and fear. Remorse for injustice must also be greater than remorse for having simply done wrong, because it adds something to remorse for having opposed the general sentiment that defends our rights, namely, remorse for having lost trust in seeing these rights respected, and for having done something wrong that has worse consequences because it violates an accepted rule and brings added injury to its victims. The sentiment that leads us to be just is stronger than the one that directs us to do good, because it is accompanied by a fear of more intense remorse. But the satisfaction we derive from justice is perhaps weaker than what we get from having done someone good directly. They are both grounded in sympathy, and the satisfaction of justice is as strong as the other. But it seems to be different in kind. Peace enters into it more. It is less active and less lovely to have. From the idea of right and justice is born the idea of our obligations towards other people. If someone could, without infringing any of our rights, require us to do something whether or not we wanted to, then we are obliged to do it. That is the strict meaning of obligation, which applies only to actions required by absolutely rigorous justice. But in speaking of actions that someone could, without infringing our rights, oblige us to perform, I don't mean could, in the sense of real and physical possibility, only ideal possibility. Thus, for example, one can say that a judge is obliged to judge on the basis of what he believes to have been proved, though it is physically impossible to force him to do so. There you have it, my dear friend. Our actions subjected to two rules, reason and justice, the latter being nothing but reason reduced to an absolute rule. We have already found very powerful internal grounds for obeying these two rules, namely the internal satisfaction of doing good to others, and remorse for having done them wrong. There is also a third, the immediate pleasure of following reason and of carrying out an obligation. I am sure that the occurrence of these feelings owes nothing to what anyone else thinks. The pleasure of following reason appears to have the same source as the pleasure we get from feeling our own strength. We experience a pleasant feeling in following our reason, because we tell ourselves that if we were drawn by an unreasonable impulse to do harm in some way, reason would be our resource for resisting the impulse and avoiding the harm. Most of what I have told you in my fourth letter about the pleasure of exercising our faculties applies here even more absolutely, because reason is one of our most wide-ranging, useful, and important faculties. What more comforting and gentle feeling is there than that of recognizing through experience that one possesses such a guide, such a guardian of our happiness, such a guarantor of our inner peace? Our pleasure in following our reason is also combined with the feeling of being free, and the feeling of having a sort of independence of and supremacy over any immediate causes that might be harmful to us. This pleasure thus reassures us, elevates us in our own eyes, and satisfies the natural inclination we all have to depend on ourselves alone, an inclination that comes from the greater confidence we have of our well-being when it is in our own hands. The pleasure we take in carrying out an obligation is immediately linked to a sense of security, to the comfort of feeling oneself sheltered from resentment, vengeance, and hatred, the special satisfaction of having avoided the regret that would have followed us if we had acted differently, boosted by the hope of never having to experience remorse, an exquisite hope, because it banishes the idea of every internal obstacle to our happiness. So we have drives not only to do good to others, but to prefer good actions to bad ones, and just actions to unjust ones. These drives are based on our natural sympathy, itself a consequence of our sensibility. Up to this point, nothing outside ourselves plays any part in this. The morality of our actions, the idea of justice, and the desire to be just, are the necessary outcomes of sensibility and of reason. Every being who can feel and think will have the same ideas about this. The limits of these ideas are the same in everyone, so these ideas can become the object of an exact science, because what they are ideas of is invariable. Of course you can express by the word just any idea you like, but there is a common notion of justice, and everyone who reasons well will have it. Given that moral ideas are not arbitrary, their definitions can vary only in how clearly and how generally they present these ideas. This base had first to be built. It had to be shown that our moral sentiments stem from our natural unthinking sympathy for the physical pains of others, and that our moral ideas stem from reflection. And above all, it had to be made clear that assent to a moral truth differs from assent to a mathematical or physical truth, in being naturally combined with a deep desire to act in accordance with it, and to see others do the same, along with a fear of not doing so, and a regret for having failed to do so. But morality cannot be said to be based purely on sentiment, desire, fear, regret, because it is reason that shows us what is just or unjust. But still less can morality be said to be based uniquely on reason, because reason's judgment is nearly always preceded by a sentiment that proclaims it and followed by one that confirms it. And because it's from this sentiment that reason first gets the moral ideas that it forms into principles. Adam Smith recognizes that reason is indisputably the source of morality's general rules, but finds it impossible to derive from reason the basic ideas of just and unjust. So he declares that these first perceptions of just/unjust are the upshot of an immediate sentiment, and claims that our knowledge of just/unjust and of virtue/vice derives in part from their harmony or disharmony with a kind of deep sense that he has postulated without defining it. However, this kind of deep sense is not one of those first causes whose existence has to be acknowledged but cannot be explained. It is simply the effect of the sympathy that our sensibility makes us liable to, the sympathy whose different appearances I have described to you, the sympathy which, when it becomes a general sentiment, can be awakened simply by abstract ideas of good and evil, and consequently must always accompany our judgments on the morality of actions. My dear friend, let us reject this dangerous tendency, whenever we encounter a fact we cannot explain, to postulate a deep sense, a faculty, a principle. This rush-to-conclusions philosophy makes no room for ignorance or doubt, imagines when it should only observe, invents causes when it cannot discover any, and not only distances us from the truth, but weakens our ability to know it when we see it. This is the sole source of the systems, so inadequate or false in their principles, that have tried to explain to man things that he cannot know, or that can't be revealed to him except through the passage of centuries, and have disfigured or weakened the power of the most useful and sacred moral truths by mixing them with monstrous fables. So when we are looking for what drives us towards being good, there is no need for us to look outside nature, and always far from it, coming up with candidates that are as incomprehensible as they are independent of our direct and immediate concerns. By his moral constitution, man is not a wicked or corrupt being, or even one who is indifferent to good, because he carries within himself a general drive towards being good and none towards being bad. But is this drive sufficient? This question, the most important in moral theory, deserves to be discussed carefully, especially given that previous treatments of it have been shallow and biased. The trouble may have been that those who have answered it decided in advance to answer, "No, it is not sufficient," so as to replace the natural supports for morality by imaginary bases that favour their interests. Or it may be that no one has tackled this question while distancing himself from the present or recent state of civilization, thinking in terms of what civilization could one day become. On the contrary, civilization has always been taken as an immutable given, or as almost incapable of being perfected. To know whether the fear of feeling remorse for an injustice sufficiently outweighs the advantage of committing it, we must examine this advantage and the cause that produces it. For if it could be proved that it is less the work of nature than of certain social institutions, and that the weakness of men's motives to act well is almost entirely the result of those institutions, one would then have to try to reform them and stop slandering human nature. If a private interest to be just was outweighed by another private interest to be unjust, and if the latter's weight could be attributed to corrupt institutions, without which the inclination to be just would nearly always be at least as strong as its opponent, then the purported inadequacy of our drives towards doing good would be merely the effect of our errors, and not of a naturally depraved disposition. If it could be shown that the influence of drives towards practicing virtue and following justice, an influence that could so easily be strengthened and spread by education, was, in fact, nearly always weakened and attacked by education, and met insurmountable obstacles in prejudices and the anti-sympathetic sentiments they give rise to, the result would be that for reasonable men these drives would nearly always be effective, failing only in rare circumstances or in actions of little importance. I don't need to prove here that they would always suffice, that all men would infallibly be just if no other drives were at work in them, but only that they would be just in most cases. In fact, the unexplained, invented drives towards doing good that morality is usually supposed to be based on nearly always miss their mark, and are even less capable than those under discussion here of acting strongly, steadily, and in a general enough manner to make them useful in all circumstances and available to all men. So all that needs to be shown is that reason alone, united with sentiment, can lead us to the good by means that are surer, gentler, easier, less complicated, and less prone to errors and dangers. And these means, far from requiring us to sacrifice or silence any of our faculties, make our intellectual perfection give birth to our moral perfection. Let us pause here, my dear friend, to see how this single capacity for experiencing pleasure and pain, at the idea of another's pleasures and pains, perfecting itself through reason and magnifying itself by reflection and enthusiasm, not only becomes for us a rich source of delightful or cruel feelings, but guarantees an always pleasant and peaceful existence to the person who, faithful to his reason and sensibility, bows to benevolence and justice, and it condemns anyone who behaves in a contrary manner to an always painful and agitated existence. The former person lives amidst the good he has done or hopes to do, and always has a deep sense of peace and security. He can remain alone with himself without experiencing emptiness or slackness, because one of his most active thoughts always centres on virtue. He is liable to pain, but at least pain cannot penetrate the sanctuary of his conscience, where there is an inexhaustible well of satisfaction, and where he can peacefully and contentedly ride out the storms of the passions, purifying them by means of delicate and generous sentiments that bring happiness, whether or not the passions are satisfied. Life and all its disappointments, people and all their weaknesses, cannot disturb or embitter him. He is easily contented with life, because it offers him pleasures that are always within his reach, that habit cannot blight, that even ingratitude on the part of those to whom he does good cannot entirely spoil. And because he considers men in terms not so much of what they could be, or probably will be, as of what happiness he can provide them with, so that in his relations with them he is not prickly or anxious. He has a hard time believing anyone would wish him harm, so he never fears being harmed, and when forced to recognize that someone has harmed him, he is more saddened than angered. Except for those to whom he is tied by a particular sympathy, it does not matter much to him what sort of human environment he is in, because the unfortunate exist everywhere. He does not have to put any effort into being free of self-interest. It hardly counts as a merit in him that he is so. And he rarely fails to touch those he loves, and to obtain happiness in return. But when he does not succeed in that, he does not experience bitter regret. An enthusiasm for virtue comes to distract him from this failure, and to console him for it. How different is the fate of the person who resists his reason and sensibility! He loses even more happiness than he can take from others. He constantly finds himself blocked from tranquillity by the vexing sentiment of his own existence. He is tormented by the need to escape from himself. The world strikes him as empty and uninhabited, because the range of things that can distract him is so small. Passions may momentarily cater to his disquiet, but in vain. They are not wild enough to dull his conscience. He no longer has the use of his faculties, and the happiness he could draw from using them retreats in face of this secret turmoil, tyrannically agitating and dominating his soul. If he seeks human company, he is soon brought back to the painful sentiment he wanted to avoid, because of his sense of how others look down on him, and the mistrust he inspires in himself. Far from seeing his fellow men as a beneficent man does, as beings who can contribute to his happiness without even trying to do so, he sees them as enemies if he thinks they are onto him, or he is forced to extremes of dissimulation and cunning. He cannot peacefully savour the satisfaction of being loved. He never has that, because he always feels he is a usurper. Uncertain of the feelings he inspires in others, he does not expect any good from them, except to the extent that he is skilful in deceiving them. They, of course, don't get any good from him. Trusting only himself, he cannot relax in the bosom of a friend, and savour there the tranquil letting go that is trust, because trust unnaturally keeps itself at a distance from him, denying him the peace that is the bedrock of all happy sentiments. He is even more guilty and more unfortunate when, tired of loathing and self-hatred, and too far from virtue to be touched or enlightened by it, he tries to lose his reason and sensibility by becoming a brute, so as to stifle the remorse that outlives the feelings and ideas that created it. End of letter 6. Letter 7. Why People Act Unjustly. All the drives that can lead a man to be unjust relate back to 4 principal interests. The interest of the passion of love, the only pleasure that cannot be bought, so that its appeal cannot be confused with the desire for money. I shall not here call love volupte, because unfortunately that word has come to stand in the language and opinion of depraved men for something that is all too often the object of a most gross commerce. The interest in having money, whether to meet needs or to acquire riches, as a vague route to pleasure. The interest of ambition, sometimes mixed with the interest in money. The interest of amour propre, or vanity, which is often the drive and the goal of the 2 preceding ones. Let us examine first of all, my dear friend, the interest in being unjust that can arise from the desire for money or for something purchasable. If it is to meet a real need, this interest can be pressing, and we sense that someone lacking everything will have few scruples about being unjust, especially with respect to a rich man, if he can hope to get away with it. But this pressing need that is strong enough to stifle the voice of conscience and to triumph over it, is it common in a society governed by reasonable laws? If the laws stopped favouring the inequality of fortunes, humanity and justice would then be satisfied. But greed, harder and slower to destroy than bad laws, would no doubt still have something to work on. Natural inequality comes from differences in behaviour, level of intelligence, and size of families. But might we not do adequate justice to those factors by thinking of them as distributing 75% of the land's productive wealth, while the other 25% was shared equally? For example, imagine a country with 6 million families and an annual agricultural income of £1.2 million. There would thus be £200 of agricultural income for each family. If the effects of natural inequality absorbed 75% of this sum, making the income of the wealthy, there would still be £50 for each family. Look at our peasants, my dear friend, and judge whether many of those with an income of £50 are reduced to poverty. On the contrary, everyone knows that as soon as they own 2 or 3 acres of arable land, they are known locally as well off. And the average productive value of 2 or 3 acres, supposing these to be optimal for growing wheat, is about £50 per annum. You will be convinced that this well-founded hypothesis is not exaggerated by observing that very many of those 6 million families will be involved in industry and commerce, with no interest in retaining their share of the nation's farmland, and even needing to urbanize it to pursue their activities or investments profitably. The pressing need that nearly always prevails over fear of retribution and fear of remorse can also arise for industrial workers, either from unemployment or because for a while wages don't keep step with the cost of living, and indeed it is most common in these classes. There is less of it among agricultural workers, because agriculture, as well as being the unique source of real and lasting wealth for states, is the richest in resources for individuals. But it has been shown conclusively in our day that unemployment and temporary shortfalls of wages have been caused almost entirely by restrictive laws that inhibit commerce and industry. These same laws also undermine the general welfare in another way, namely by allowing the gradual concentration into a few men's hands of wealth, which they can, if they choose, use as a means of oppression, and which would otherwise, i.e. without those interfering laws, have been shared out among everyone, even if not equally, this being brought about by the unrestricted interplay of competing interests. Unequal taxation ends up further overwhelming the lower class, which, without property or freedom, is reduced to counting fraud as a resource, deceiving without remorse because conscience soon fades when entangled by chains. So the interest in being unjust because of need is very rare in the absence of bad laws, and even when bad laws are in effect, it manifests itself rarely and with the least extensive and least formidable effects. You will next note, my dear friend, that the interest in being unjust so as to get money presupposes that one has a chance of succeeding in this, and this possibility of success is itself in many ways the product of the laws. If they were clear, they would warn everyone equally. If they were just, they would allow no exceptions, and if they were precise, they would leave no opening for corruption and bad faith. If civil administration among nearly all peoples did not interfere with a host of actions that ought to be left alone, it wouldn't leave an opening for arbitrary power, a power that is perhaps less sinister in its exercise than what is needed to create and maintain it. Finally, if laws alone were to govern universally, and they alone were to be feared, instead of fearing men and classes, as is so often the case, then the only way to acquire a surplus through injustice would be theft, in the strict sense of this word. In that situation, the force of remorse for being unjust would have to be balanced only against the force of the temptation to steal for gain, and not against the force of allowing oneself the quiet injustices favoured by long-standing examples, and almost authorised by the silence, or rather by the vices, of the laws. Laws should supplement the citizen's conscience, but too often they are merely oppressive chains, or at most, the occasional last break on wickedness. Now, given reasonable laws, the temptation of theft to attain more possessions would be so weakened by the costs of giving into it that theft would rarely have to be feared. The interest in being unjust that comes from vanity and ambition is even more the product of social institutions. These alone bring it about that man is dominated by man, not by the law, and that a great position is something other than a challenging public office, something that offers personal rewards beyond the honour or the glory of filling it well, something that cannot be secured merely through public service and public esteem, or through merely being thought worthy of it. Social institutions alone, in opening fortune's gates to cunning, intrigue, cabal, and corruption for all classes, separate ambition from the love of glory that would ennoble it and purify its means. Social institutions, in consecrating hereditary rights, most of which were abusive from the outset, have provided pushy mediocrity with an infallible way of rising to a great position, and indeed to a tyrannical one, for any such position is, or will become, tyrannical, unless it was established for the general interest and is limited to what that interest demands. If in all positions one were bound by the laws and obliged to act only in accordance with them, and if all positions were conferred by a general choice and by a free election, conscience would rarely have to combat the interest that leads to crime,
and the injustices that ambition can inspire. Morality would even cease needing to reproach the ambitious for the weakness of character, the cowardice in opinions, the base flattery, the art of toadying to vice and vanity. In short, all the corrupting means that are too often required for success, and that quietly undermine all the foundations of the virtues. Vanity, attached to non-personal things, is obviously the work of depraved social institutions, because all these things owe their existence to these institutions, which have pointlessly adopted them by always preferring individual and local interests to the general interest. As for pride born of personal advantages, it becomes dangerous and potentially criminal. Only when general opinion, led astray by institutions, exaggerates the worth of trivial qualities. The vanity of good looks and external charms is a passion that spawns jealousies and intense hatreds only in countries where there are courts, grandees, and ruinous fortunes, where favouritism is in play, and being favoured is the marker of how high one has risen, and where these charms can lead to anything, and can sometimes even produce revolutions. In such countries, even men of the lower classes, who cannot aspire to these brilliant successes, view them with admiration and envy, and are excited by accounts of them. As in Rome, the lowest soldiers, who could not hope for any honours in the formal triumph in which they marched, came away from that ceremony drunk with the fury of conquest. The same is true for vanity based on intellect and talent. It is dangerous only when the seduced multitude lavishes on charlatans and hypocrites the esteem and rewards that should go only to true merit. But let all faulty institutions be abolished worldwide. Let only necessary and reasonable laws remain, and say goodbye to the arbitrary power that sinks its victims into misery and servitude, and reduces them to ignorance and credulity, and human reason will re-emerge, healthy and vigorous, from beneath its chains, predominating in all classes, and itself shaping public opinion. False talent will no longer be able to seduce public opinion, and disguised vices will no longer risk appearing before its tribunal. Besides, what is at stake in this battle against bad faith and base jealousy is not glory. Genuine glory is indisputable, and is fought for only by means worthy of obtaining it. All that can be usurped and snatched by injustice are the outward signs of glory. Immoral actions, driven by love, must also be imputed to these same faulty institutions. By love, I do not mean the tender, profound, often generous and always delicate sentiment, which has as its primary pleasure the pleasure of loving, has as its primary aim the sweetness of being loved, has as its most constant concern the happiness and tranquillity of the loved one, wants to receive everything, grant everything, and deserve everything through the heart, and recognizes only the sensuality that it prepares for and approves. This passion is not the common one. It involves a mutual sympathy that is hard to find, and even harder to recognize, a generous character and strong sensibility that are rare, and are nearly always accompanied by some other superior qualities. Nor is it a passion that often leads to injustice, because what it leads to, what it consists in, is a two-way devotion, which inspires both parties to make sacrifices, yet doesn't allow either to accept any sacrifice that would harm the other, an automatic forgetting of oneself, in order to enter into the existence and the happiness of the person one loves. Besides, the duration and the fineness of these feelings enables them nearly always to pass smoothly over obstacles, and their generosity and freedom from self-interest usually lead them to judge themselves nearly as severely as conscience does. So, in general, the only love that can be a drive towards an interest in being unjust is the desire to possess, or to have possessed, some woman. Society has given this desire extra power, through faulty institutions that stir up pride and vanity. But if we set that aside, and look at this love in isolation, we will find straight off that the inequality that the laws have produced has by itself created an idle class of men for whom gallantry is an occupation, a pastime, a game, and made it easy to sacrifice victims to the flames of this passion, putting it into the service of ambition and cupidity. Here is an imagined state of affairs that would put a stop to this. Imagine that this same inequality, and the laws dreamed up to support it, stopped reducing most marriages to mere contracts and commercial exchanges, signed off on so quickly that only long afterwards can anyone tell whether individual wishes played a part in them, contracts in which the sale price of love is set along with the dowry, before either party knows if he or she can love, or especially be loved. Imagine also that man stopped subjecting his inconstant heart, and even more variable will, to unbreakable ties that clash with his nature, whose mobility and proud independence require a habitual sense of being free. Imagine that divorce becomes permissible among all peoples, and that in the light of human weakness and the more persistent needs of one of the sexes, it becomes possible, as in ancient Rome, to form temporary unions that the law regulates and does not punish. Then one would see right away that most of the unjust actions occasioned by love, or rather by the degradation of love, would have nothing to drive them, and that the ease of satisfying that passion would deprive it of the dangerous force it now gets from the obstacles to it. So it is society which has given birth to dangerous and corrupt passions that are not love, and have made real love so rare. It has done this by placing hobbles on unions that mutual likings would have formed, establishing, under the pretext of maintaining virtue, barriers between the sexes that virtually rule out the mutual understanding of hearts and minds that is needed for virtuous and enduring unions, arousing the vanity of men, and giving them an interest in corrupting women, making pleasure accompanied by some feeling more difficult, and extending the realm of shame beyond what really deserves it, such as not securing the welfare of one's children, promise-breaking, contemptible going along with, and character flaws indicating weakness or lack of self-control. It would be easy to apply to women everything I have said here about men on this subject, and to justify the opinion of a philosopher who is even more wise than famous. The faults of women are the work of men, just as the vices of nations are the crime of their tyrants. You have just seen, my dear friend, how the vices of social institutions help stir up the various interests we have for being unjust. But this, the strengthening of these interests, is not their only way of making conscience too weak to be effective. They also weaken conscience's power by giving people the habit of resisting it. The drives we might have for committing injustice, having acquired greater force through the errors of the social system, have led men to act badly more often than conscience has been able to keep them from doing so. That resulted in the influence of conscience being weakened, in some people by the habit of brushing off its warnings, and in others by the habit of violating it, because frequency of engaging in or seeing bad behaviour indirectly lessens remorse and the fear of being exposed to it, except in robust souls whose sense of justice and goodness has an incorruptible strength. Here is why I say that frequently acting badly or seeing others do so lessens remorse in an indirect way. We naturally seek to rid ourselves of any painful feeling, and a man tormented by remorse will try to distance himself from ideas that involve it, and to surround himself with all the reasons that can lighten its burden. At this point, vicious institutions finish the task they have started. They provide the man with the means for long-term misreading of his own heart. They even give him leave to consider as inevitable, as necessary, as politically neutral, or even as useful, the evil for which the institutions are responsible, and for which they then become the excuse. Also, habit alone dulls every feeling. Pain and pleasure, especially when mild, are always increased by contrast with the recent different state. One of the factors in the intensity of any joy or suffering that we experience is the state we were in when it started. And this holds also for a man who is merely a habitual witness to injustice. It becomes attenuated in his eyes, unless he has a firm intellect that can't be taken in by the excuses of vice, as well as the strong, manly sensibility that cannot be misled or corrupted, and that can remain indignant for a long time without becoming unpleasantly weary. As vice becomes more common, its successes become proportionally more brilliant, more visible, and simply bigger, and the real interest in acting badly is stimulated by the hope of getting in this way the means for vaster and more daring projects. The price manipulator, who pulls off a little swindle to win 50 gold coins, has before his eyes the certified Croesus, who has gained millions through something similar. Greed does not stop at the advantages a few silver coins might bring. The fanaticism of greed lets him look ahead to the moment when he will have heaps of gold. It has already corrupted his conscience. So the authority of an ordinary conscience, together with reasonable laws, would suffice for man to be just and good. But ever since social institutions in so many nations have degraded human nature, more often than they have perfected it, have given man incomplete and false moral ideas and passions, more dangerous than his natural ones, and have led him to lose the rectitude and original vigour of his conscience which man has needed, if he is to stay on the path of virtue, the power and insight that nature so rarely gives, and that he, being out of touch with her, can get only by listening to her voice in deep and thoughtful meditation. End of letter 7.